O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frightened thee, that now no more wilt weight my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, for you tread on my dreams. Welcome to Perchance to Dream, written and produced by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective and The Writer's Place in Madison, Wisconsin. It is often said that we spend about one-third of our lives sleeping, and much of that dreaming. In the next hour of Mind's Eye Radio, we'll explore what roles dreams and sleep play in our modern lives. I have had a more rare vision. I have had a dream past the wit of man to say what dream it was. Man is but an ass if he go about to expound this dream. So says Bottom in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. The bard put it better than most of us ever could, but the phenomenon of dreaming, as associated with having visions, is something Gay Davidson-Zilski has experienced. In her case, she sometimes dreams literature.
The first time it happened, that feeling upon waking about 2 a.m, I had a short but complete one-act play stuck in my head. Since my writing space is barely 12 feet from the bed, I was able to stumble to the computer, fire it up with that pleasant rocket-launching sound it makes as it begins to blink, and write until there were no more ideas coming. The resultant play, A Glass Cat on a Streetcar Named So-So, is a silly send-up of Tennessee Williams' plays, except that my dream was set not in New Orleans, but on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin, burning with those old implacable fires of a recent football victory. The play came in my sleep equipped with characters, Big Virtual Dada, his wife Miranda Veranda, a son Bubba, and a daughter. It appeared complete with jokes. Bubba breaks a leg, out tipping cows, and Dada asks him in a booming voice, "How do you tip a cow, boy?" To which Bubba replies, "I think the regular 15% is adequate for a Holstein." I never did anything with this play, you understand, until recently when on a whim I tried to slip it over the transom to Michael, what do you know, Feldman, who ignored it, I guess, if he received it at all. I admit it's bizarre writing, but I thought it more coherent than most dreams and some modern drama I've seen. Then I dreamed a series of flower poems, one for each month, but all dreamed in the same night. I dutifully pulled myself from the warm sheets and typed out the 12 small fragments. They are not great works of literature. One goes, "Amaryllis, the brazen hussy, shocks the prim snow of January." But I always reserve judgment on the quality of the work until the cruel light of day, if I'm able to actually get back to sleep afterwards. But even on second thought, these seemed like passable poems. Sort of drive-by haiku, but not so bad. When I awake to record the dreams, I try not to go on typing once the quivering candle of the actual dream gutters out. This much I believe I owe to the muse. If you are one who dreams literature, you can confirm how downright spooky this phenomenon becomes. I feel as if I am only a filter through which someone else is pouring ideas. So when I feel myself becoming crafty and begin to strain after plot, I let it go. I'm not sure why, but this fiddling with the story seems like cheating. Once I dreamed a story and felt so convinced it was my best sleep-written story ever that I emailed the remnant to an acquaintance who suffers insomnia on the chance that he was up prowling at 3 a.m. I was right, but he has still not forgiven me for leaving him sleepless and cliffhanging. Probably the most delightful story to me, written and finished while I slept, was a dream about a girl who could summon song. She finds her talent quite by accident, discovering that not only can she predict the song that will come on the radio right after the one that's currently playing, but that she can install any tune she wants into the head of the other person she wishes to haunt. But she uses her powers to do evil, causing the Methodist carolers to sing, "We three kings of Orient are Ike and Spike and Hetty Lamar." and finally getting even with a guy who has ditched her by planting the most annoying advertising jingle she can think of into his head. In the story as I dreamed it, she doesn't get stripped of her goddess-like power as punishment for her misuse of it. But if I ever rewrite The Girl Who Could Summon Song, I may add this ironic twist. I don't know how to tell you to prepare your mind to sleep right if you should ever want to. It doesn't seem associated with anything I do or don't do or eat or don't eat. I'm not even aware of wanting to write, any more than I always do, which is considerable, I guess. If anyone out there has discovered the secret of making it happen at will, I hope you will let me know about it. I have heard that Jacqueline Michard rode the technique all the way to fame with her novel, The Deep End of the Ocean, originally prompted by a dream. I guess my best advice is to be sure to get up and write that dream down before it evaporates. Force yourself. It's kind of cool watching daylight creep upon your garden while you sit in the first light, already writing. My husband puts up with it, and usually it's sort of like Christmas to get up and find that you've already written. And try not to be too critical of the product. Even if your total output sounds maybe too much like the braying of an ass or of a bottom. This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky with Mind's Eye Radio.
Late at night, and you're sleeping, you'll hear my lonesome call, and you'll feel my waiting lips barely touching you at all. But it's only as real as any dream can see. I'll see you in your wildest dream.
Are dreams reality, or is reality a dream? Poet Jackie Wilson finds that sleep and dreams are both real and unreal, a concept explored in her poem, Zebra Reality.
Bars of moonlight materialize through shuttered blinds to dissolve my pillow into the prison dimension of dreams. Slipping in and out of this reality.
For many people, dreams are not just outlandish stories that come to us in the night. Dreams capture our waking hopes and fantasies, which help us achieve great things in our waking world. Essayist Fran Zell found that nowhere was this link more evident than in the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I remember where I was on April 4, 1968, the day Martin Luther King, Jr., one of our century's most eminent dreamers, was killed. I had just graduated from college, was spending a few weeks at home in Ohio before heading for a job on a newspaper in Michigan. I remember what my mother said when news of his violent death came over the radio. It does not bear repeating here or anywhere. I remember my shocked silence in the face of my mother's racial prejudice and my inability to contradict her. How often I wish that I, my mother, my whole family, and so many others in America had not been sleeping while Dr. King dreamed. Of course, I wish this again while reading Dreamer, the beautifully rendered new novel by Charles Johnson. In this book, Dreamer, Johnson alters the nature of historical fiction. The life he explores ended only 30 years ago, and the struggle for equal rights continues. But all the characters, places, and events in the book are either imagined by the author or used fictitiously. For those of us who lived through the movement's turbulent years, this novel takes on all the mysterious qualities of a dream. Set in the year leading up to King's death, Dreamer presents an intimate picture of its main character. We see Martin Luther King, Jr. as a man whose waking dreams led him to greatness, and a man whose life became so stressful and frenetic that he sometimes went for days on only 4 hours of sleep. There was always another speech or sermon to write, another appearance to make, another problem to solve, another early morning flight to catch, another march for freedom to lead. When King really needed sleep, he checked into a hospital. When he slept, King sometimes dreamed. In the novel, he dreams of the glorious sunset on a breathtaking beach in India, where he once traveled with Coretta, his wife, to affirm his dedication to nonviolence. Dreams and sleep are emblematic in other ways in this richly textured book. In flashback, we learn of King's so-called kitchen conversion, the culmination of a long, sleepless night during his Montgomery campaign, in which he questioned his calling and his faith. When he at last saw the light, we are told, he felt as if he had awakened from a dream, the dream that fosters a sense of separateness and belief in a self. King and his nonviolent movement form the focal point of this book, but there are other key characters and important themes. Dreamer is a story of doubles, warring brothers, envy, inequality, and the nature of greatness. It is also a wake-up call for dreamers and sleepers alike. This is Fran Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
Charles Johnson won the National Book Award for Dreamer, published this year by Scribner.
Dr. King was a civil rights leader. Dr. King, he had a dream. He wanted everybody to live like sisters. He wanted everybody to live like sisters. He wanted everybody to live like sisters and make the dreams come true. Dr. King was a civil rights leader. Dr. King, he had a dream. He wanted everybody to live like brothers. He wanted everybody to live like brothers. He wanted everybody to live like brothers and make his dreams come true. One more time. Dr. King was a civil rights leader. Dr. King, he had a dream.
The line between waking and dreaming sometimes becomes blurred, a feeling experienced by Sharon Van Sluice. In her poem, The Caller, she reveals how our nightly visions can become harbingers of change.
The Caller. There is a knocking. A knocking, and behind my eyes I know I am dreaming. My body and mind floats and opens the door to a flock of Jehovah's disciples, combed and washed neat as the first day of school. He is a cutout of navy blue suit. His earnest flat face is scraped hairless. Around him a halo of faint, sexless scent. What is it, naphthalene? Camphor? Beside him, the wife is blonde, but not too, and blankly demure in her seer's dress. Angelic, their pinky pink child peers up, a little too clean and too quiet. They ask me sincerely, as witnesses do, "Aren't you concerned about the state of our world?" Somehow this morning, I have the right words. I fold my arms slowly, my heart calms to reason. "No," I say, "no, really, no, I'm just waiting for the damn thing to blow. Won't it be glorious?" Their smooth, saintly faces grow pale and pop. I'm awake in a knot of sheets, the sun sifting in weak and flowery. Still there's a knocking. I see through the pane a great, spiky-beaked bird, zebra-cloaked wings, a blood-scarlet skullcap, ferocious and focused, black bullet eyes. He sees me. He knows me. I fall in love instantly. Quick, let me slip on my batwing raincoat. Quick, let me slide on my ocelot boots. This spearbird is knocking. He knows what I'm thinking. This conjurer is calling. He knows what I am. He's knocking. He's calling. He's got all the answers. Quick, throw it open. We'll fly.
This and other poems written by Sharon Van Sluice are published in her book, Under the Influence of Blackbirds, available from New River Press. Who are these people in our dreams, anyway? And why do we care what we dream? Are we afraid that exploring dreams will dredge up something from our subconscious better left alone? Writer Fran Rawl tries to fix her dreams when they become confusing.
A lot of my dreams seem to come from definite events. My Nita Hill dream is of a woman who's working with a sly, mischievous man she wants to distance herself from. In an effort to exert control, she says he cannot drink whiskey from that round bottle with her in the car. She gives her jealous husband a phone number where she can be reached. I think that the husband is the public she's trying to deal with. Many times after a dream, I try to affect the events. Either I go back to sleep or drift into sleep delving and let ideas flow. Another dream takes place during a banquet in an Arab country. It has big overtones of power and sex, which are hard to separate. The women, including me, are told by an Arab manservant that they are to go to the end of the room, remove all present clothes, and put on the robes they're handed. Even underwear is considered unclean. I soon notice that the robes are too transparent, and the men are not asked to turn their backs while we change. As usual, I try to fix things. I get a pen and paper and write, "We must have underwear, the men must turn their backs, or we will eat alone in the room." This isn't satisfactory to them. At the end of the dream, awake or asleep, I know what to do. I demand that we are furnished with abbas, the black, all-enveloping, everyday dress decent Muslim women wear outside the home. This solution the men can't argue with. One dream I don't need to fix is about the death of my dear, gentle friend. Like Y.S. Christine, she crawls up a hill toward huge wrought iron gates. When she gets there, I see that they zip open and bend inward. Then we're both inside, standing at the edge of a tall cliff, a strong wind blowing. It seems dangerous to me, so I lie down with my head over the edge. She is still standing there, and I warn her that she might get dizzy and fall. The people below us are gently floating past in a steady stream, just white figures. When I turn to look at her again, she's gone. This is Fran Rawl from Mind's Eye Radio and Writer's Place.
Tacy Rozalowski shares Fran's experience, but in her case, it's the images in the media that creep on cat's toes into her dreams.
Number 4 or 5 on my list of most memorable dreams is this dream I had a few years ago. I was looking at a huge, elaborately painted and paneled room filled with gilded furniture upholstered in sherbet-colored brocades. Two of my friends were there. In keeping with the Louis XIV atmosphere, they were dressed as servants. They sat on low stools, polishing an enormous pile of silverware. I could just make out my two busy pals in the soft candlelight falling from a large chandelier. Okay, I'll admit it. There were dead puppies hanging from the chandelier instead of cut crystal drops. Even stranger, the dream space suddenly split. The left edge of the visual screen moved a little toward the center, and another image appeared. A man in a powdered wig and a powder blue outfit. I knew he was a prince. He was crammed into that small space, having sex with a really strange-looking red-haired woman in a lilac dress and lacy bloomers. Aside from the dead puppies and the sexy elements that prove my mind doesn't think a cigar is just a cigar, the split screen really caught my attention. It looked just like the images at the ends of programs on the Fox network, when the credits run on one side of the screen while exciting scenes from next week's show roll by on the other. In fact, I had this dream just after Fox started using this visual device. We all know of artists who claim to simply recreate their dreams. Surrealists like Dali and Chagall made careers by letting the unconscious flow out freely into paint and onto canvas. And one of my favorites, H.R. Giger, of Alien fame, also draws his dreams. He poured out particularly nightmarish worlds for 20th Century Fox. But for most of us, images travel the other way. Art and media flow into us. They provide us with tools to give our inner worlds visual form. And it is form I'm talking about here, not content. In a recent dream, I was doing jury duty, and the defendant kept turning into Wishbone, which is a dog on a PBS kids show, for those of you not in the know. I'm not interested in that kind of media import. I'm talking about how media shapes the way dreams are shot, to use a metaphor from film. Psychoanalyst Robert Stoller says that the dreaming part of us is like a film director. I like this metaphor because the look of a dream adds a lot to its emotional impact and meaning. A dream shot in close-ups and point-of-view images looks and feels very different than a dream that unfolds in panoramas. Neither of the big systems of dream interpretation can handle this kind of thing. Freud is very language-focused. He doesn't pay any attention to the look of dreams. Jungian analysis is fascinated with visual symbols, but the humanist Jungian wants to show that we all share a collective set of symbols and that these symbols remain stable through time. Stability is one thing that media is not about. Our minds hunger for visual novelty, and technology works hard and fast to feed our heads. My unconscious gobbles up whatever is offered. I remember mastering the chaotic movement of asteroids, my favorite video game in the early 1980s. It showed up in my dreams right around the time that George Lucas took that sort of imagery to new heights in The Empire Strikes Back. I started having dreams drenched in what I call Ridley Scott blue, the reflected cobalt light made famous in Alien and Blade Runner. Later there were wormholes, like those in Babylon 5 and Contact. On one hand, I love these imports. I'm delighted when my dream director finds new special effects for my viewing pleasure, but there is a nightmarish edge to all of this. Sometime in the 70s, a psychoanalyst used deep hypnosis to tap into his patients' most private thoughts about themselves. They came up with phrases like, "You deserve a break today." Media detritus formed a sedimentary layer on the mind's deepest structures. They didn't even personalize the ad copy. This makes it even harder to draw the line between what's uniquely ours and what belongs to culture. Dreams, like so much of what's in our minds, aren't completely private creations. Sven Burkertz, author of the Gutenberg Elegies, argues that electronic culture is changing the shape of consciousness. He says it adds breadth and quantity of information, but takes away depth and complexity. I take issue with some of Burkert's ideas, but there's no doubt that media culture is changing the look and style of the unconscious. To paraphrase Ross Perot, that great sucking sound is the media draining into our heads. This is Tacy Rozalowski for Mind's Eye Radio.
Pause for a moment.
What is it?
Pause for a moment. And reflect on this very thoughtfully. You can actually cause the consumer to forget something he has previously learned.
Hey, hey, hey. It's cool.
By putting into his head a newer and stronger concept as we seize a larger and larger share of the consumer's brain box.
It's the smile you can hide in the back of your mind.
But it's easy to see and no surprise to me.
Oh. The choice of a negative generation.
It may very well be weighty concerns that keep us awake at night. But perhaps the real cause is simply too much caffeine. Recent studies have suggested that most Americans are sleep-deprived, a fact that may be causing job anxiety in one well-known figure. Here now are the Mind's Eye Players.
Here you are, Vic. One triple espresso with legs. And if that doesn't perk you up, nothing will.
Thanks, Greta. I've been up all night finishing a report and cramming for my night classes.
Well, you won't be snoozing anytime soon with that high octane pumping through your veins.
I'll probably be awake for a week. But if not, I'll be back later in a few hours for a refill. Bye.
buddy.
Huh? You talking to me?
Yeah, I'm talking to you. You want to score some sand, mister?
What? Sand?
Yeah, sand. I've got your 4-hour packets, your 8-hour packets, and even some 12-hour packets if you're really hurting.
Sand?
What, you dumb or something? Yeah, I'm talking about sand. I'm the Sandman, see? And I can tell you're someone who's gone too long without sleep. So maybe you and I can do business, eh?
Hey, man. Sleep is the last thing I need. I'm heading for work now. I got 2 finals tonight.
Oh, come on, mister. A few hours of Z's will do you some good. Your brain. Well, thank you.
No thanks. I gotta finish this report.
Hey, don't walk away, buddy. I'll give you a really good deal. $5 for a full night's sleep.
Not interested. I told you. Staying awake is my problem, not sleep.
Oh, sure. You're just like all the rest. Places to go, people to see, all that crap. You've no idea how hard it is to sell sleep in this town nowadays. Nobody wants to sleep. You should see how people pack away the soda, the coffee, the Earl Grey tea. Always on the go, always on the go. It's disgusting.
I can see your point, but really, I gotta get going. See ya.
Okay, you got me. $1. Just $1 for a quarter bag. You'll sleep for a few hours, tops.
No thanks, old man. I told you. I have to get to work now. Then I pick up my kids, take my daughter to dance lessons, fix dinner because my wife's working overtime, and then I have a final in my MBA class tonight. I barely got time to eat, let alone sleep. I gotta go.
Don't go, mister. Here, take this free sample. Just a little snort, you'll be out for 15 minutes. Come on, you need this. Mister. Oh, to heck with it. Say, Greta, set me up with a mocha latte, will ya?
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Don't have nobody to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam.
You're listening to Perchance to Dream on Mind's Eye Radio. Stay with us.
Mr. Sandman.
Yes?
Bring us a dream. Give him a pair of eyes with a come-hither gleam. Give him a lonely heart like Pagliacci. And lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Mr. Sandman. Someone to hold would be so peachy before we're too old. So please turn on your magic beam, Mr. Sandman, bring us. Please, Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
Imagine yourself lying in a well-made bed in the cool of a summer evening, looking out the window at a starry sky of storied constellations. This poem was written from the tradition the Greeks employed, projecting onto the constellations their gods and goddesses, acting out emotions of envy, love, and hate. Though these stars and their myths are centuries old, Karen Schultz still feels their influence.
City lights. The summer moon beams golden yellow as a disc sent from Greek gods. Its glow circles and melts into the gray blue of the early evening sky. 10 o'clock, the orb evolves into silver as a naive face turned knowing. Midnight, Andromeda's celestial figure appears before the sky's curtain of black silk. Perseus presents himself near her. Cepheus, Big Dipper, Little Dipper crowd the heavenly stage. Polaris directs the actors and audience with brilliant flair. I wonder who else sits in this dark theater.
Andromeda cries out, "Night in the city lights, you mock me. My reflection becomes unavailable, my beauty dimmed." Venus laughs, the night shifts. Cassiopeia takes her place in the lights. Perseus reminds her to see where Dipper now tips his handle in the north, his pot pouring out pure black air onto wheat fields. In darkness, Cassiopeia is easily perceived, her jealousy no longer concealed. The audience revels in Andromeda's triumph. Star wanderers dart in amusement. Crickets once solo try chorus. Winds tryst in the trees, chimes bong, and the owls sing out their joy. I applaud the masters of the universe. Lying on cranberry cotton, I was given this production, a la visions and voices, complimentary. Staring into darkness for freedom, I beheld the constellation's story about light. For this, curtains are suspended open, lights remain off. The tale continues in slumber's reverie. To the west, a new audience gathers. There, someone is trying to turn off the city. This is Karen Schultz for Mind's Eye Radio and Writer's Place.
Number nine, 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 number nine. number nine, 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 number nine.
While being kept awake by visions of ancient stories, Luis Mancuso recalls a sleepless evening brought on by more immediate concerns. She tells a story in her poem, Night Care.
Bida sits in her chair, staring. It's time for bed, but there is no familiar movement, no ritual clicking off of TV, no rising from her chair to make her way to the bathroom where she will floss her teeth and dress for bed. Something is wrong, but I'm not sure what. Are you okay, Bida? I ask. My question goes unanswered. I touch her arm. It may as well be wood. The minutes pass. The clock chimes. It's time for the bus to come and swallow me up. I wait for the turn of her head, for the light to return to diminished eyes. I will stay as long as it takes. And it takes more time for her tongue to loosen, gibberish escaping lips used to quoting poets and priests that prodded and praised and blessed. I bless you now, Bida, as you struggle to your feet, as you rush to outrun this striking down, this stroke, this terrible sudden smite of your power. I make a call, agree to stay the night. No way I will leave you, Bida. No way I will chance your being taken. I wear a path between bedroom and parlor, hear each sigh, each tremulous crying out. Where's that Italian girl? You still do not know me. I kiss your forehead, listen as you tell me how your sister Emily, dead so many years, came to stand by your bed. You nod off, and I know there is no sleep for me, no time I will close my eye. Weary, I ring in the dawn with my hands, go out to the kitchen for coffee. Outside the window, a cardinal makes a meal from dampened seed. I need his brazen red, his bold assertion of life. I need to know that you will be all right. I take a sip of coffee, grateful for its warmth and goodness. Like Bida is good, caring for mother, then father, caring for her students who, after 50 years, return to hold her hand and thank her. Caring for this Italian girl she taught to garden, to call wildflowers by name, and that integrity is a virtue still to be cherished. In the distance, a chickadee, chee-chee-chee-chees. Pleased and feeling much more at ease, I turn back to the doorway and see Bida, looking frail, looking spent, the glint again in her bluest of eyes. Louise, she says. Louise? This is Louise Mancuso for The Writer's Place in Mind's Eye Radio.
Starry, starry night. Flaming flowers that brightly blaze. Swirling clouds in violet haze. Reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue. Colors changing hue. Morning fields of amber grain. Weathered faces lined in pain are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.
Old Man Coyote rubs his eyes awake. He wanders a bit disoriented.
He's used to the confusion.
Storyteller Jim Winship.
When Coyote sleeps, he moves through space and time, and he's never sure when and where he is upon awaking. Old Man Coyote, one of the first people around before time was time. Coyote's done some good things in his time. It was Old Man Coyote who first brought fire to the humans. The Earthmaker had created them in the warmth of summertime, and for months they were fine. But when the cold wind blew, they huddled together for warmth. There was fire in one place, but protected by swarming bees who stung whoever got close. Coyote saw the humans shivering, no coat to keep them warm. Coyote can change form at will, and he changed into his archetypal coyote form. He then loped over to where the bees were swarming around the fire, raced directly at them, did a hairpin turn, and ran away. He swung his tail into the fire as he turned and scampered away with a crackling, burning tail, trailing stinging bees. Forest fire started from the burning tail, and the people had fire. But now the humans are more plentiful than bees, and Coyote stops and listens to their talking, realizing he is somewhere in North America. On a clothesline, he finds and borrows a pair of jeans and a t-shirt with a beer bottle in the writing, "It's not just for breakfast anymore." Changes into a 20-something male and heads for the nearest city to figure out where he is. He strolls through the streets. He sees adolescents listening to their Discmans, slightly older humans working on their Bill Gates mans. Must be the early 21st century. He sniffs the air, looks for landmarks, listens for accents. It used to be that cities and states and regions were very different, but they're getting to be more and more the same. Not enough for Coyote to distinguish where he is. The storyteller's on the other side of the city street. He recognizes Coyote, crosses the street, and matches him stride for stride. Looking for enlightenment, Coyote is asked by the storyteller, "Please tell me, Coyote, what is power?" Coyote, not at all perturbed at being identified, responds, "Power is the ability to start your chainsaw on the first pull." "Please tell me, Coyote, what's magic?" Coyote pauses for a second and answers, "Magic? It's the first taste of ripe strawberries. It's a child dancing in summer rain." The storyteller's not sure he's gotten enlightened, but he liked the answers. He heads one way and Coyote heads the other way, thinking perhaps in the country, away from the city, it'll be easier to determine where he is. Coyote wanders through the countryside, sees grass greener than grass has a right to be, black and white cows. Could be Vermont, but there are no mountains at the horizon. Probably the upper Midwest, but hard to tell if it's Minnesota or Iowa, Wisconsin or Michigan. Coyote has enough trouble figuring out the border between the sublime and the ridiculous. He's not going to trifle over state lines. Besides, he's getting sleepy. So he slouches toward a shady area, dozes off again.
The storyteller Jim Winship with the modern version of a Native American tale.
It's time for bed, little cat, little cat. So snuggle in tight. That's right, like that. It's time for bed, little cat, little cat. What happened today that made you laugh? It's time for bed, little sheep. The whole wide world is going to sleep.
downstairs and get ready for night-night. Let's go get ready to get on our beds. I'm going to change one more diaper, and then we're going to have nap time. All your beds are ready. Sue's going to pass out your blankets. Here you go, dear. Take this to your bed. Take that over to your bed. Come on, baby Jeff. Oh, you guys are doing a good job going to your beds for night. Good job. Jack, there's your bed. Aiden, there's your blanket that you like to lay on. Abigail, there's your doll. Ivy, there's your baby doll.
Baby doll.
It's time for all the babies to go night-night. We all have dry diapers. We all have stories. Okay, Abigail, there's your bed. Good night. Good night. Back rubs. Lay down. Lay down. I'll rub your back. There's your baby. Yeah, your baby's there. There's your baby doll. I'm gonna help Rachel take off her shoes for night-night. Yeah. I'm take off shoes so we can relax. I have them right here for after nap. We're going to take our rest first. Yeah, it'll be fine. There you go, dear. There you go. Can I rub your back, Aiden? Abigail, it's time to lay down, hon. Where's your baby? Where's your baby? There's your baby. There's your baby. Night-night. Okay, Amy. Night-night, sweetie. Good night. Good night. Oh, everybody has lots of wiggling to do today. There. Night-night. Steven, back on your bed, please. Good night. Shh. It's nighty night time. It's time for night night. Yeah, it's time for night night. There's your blanket. There's your blanket with all the animals. There you go. It's right there. There you go. There you go.
Writer Paul Thompson knows those one-year-olds in daycare have the right idea. If he had his way, everyone would enjoy a midday nap.
It's a guilty pleasure, like having that piece of cake, like not flossing, like reading People magazine. I'm talking about napping. Our society frowns on napping. Napping doesn't add to the gross national product. But come early afternoon, my eyelids drag downward like anchors. Now that I work at home, the call of the couch is often impossible to resist. In defense of my sloth, let me argue that napping is in our genes. For animals like rabbits and cats, life is a series of naps. We primates do most of our sleeping at night, but napping persists. Our closest relative, the chimp, often nods off in the heat of the day. During childhood, we recapitulate evolution. As infants, we wake around the clock and demand room service. Our schedule gradually consolidates into sleep at night and a daily nap that gives our parents an opportunity to nap as well. Nap Scene 1. I am 4 years old. My mother stretches out on the bed to rest. I nestle close beside her and fall asleep. On cold days, we cuddle more closely. She calls me her little furnace. Freudians, get out of here. This is sacred territory. The nap almost disappears for elementary-age children. It returns with the teen years and young adulthood, not to everyone, but to a good many. Nap Scene 2. In college, I and my beatnik wannabe friends drink beer and coffee and talk about God, life, and T.S. Eliot until 3 in the morning. My days are spent looking for places to snooze. My favorite hideout is the Student Union Library, a little frequented room where one can sink with a book into a deep leather chair. It's like an exclusive club. I spend many hours dozing there instead of studying or attending class. In fact, I nap my way to expulsion. I finish my degree only after marriage when, to use Ann Landers' phrase, I wake up and smell the coffee. Here are some nap factoids. Frequency of napping gradually increases with age. When it comes to gender, napping is an equal opportunity habit. Afternoon drowsiness seems to be a natural body rhythm rather than a result of eating lunch, and a nap does not ordinarily detract from night sleep. Cultures vary in their attitude toward the nap. Many countries near the equator have a siesta culture where business halts for a meal and nap during the heat of the day. But this very sensible practice is giving way to Western efficiency. Chile, that paragon of developing capitalism, has banned the siesta. For the West, as economist R. H. Taney observed many years ago, has transferred Puritanism from religion to economics. We are sanctified by hard work and accumulation. The modern pilgrim's progress is a drive down the superhighway to success. I like success, but I need many rest stops along the way. Final nap scene. I am stretched out on the bed on a summer afternoon. Sunlight dapples the wall. Bird twitters drift through the window. My eyelids begin their descent. I think of Longfellow's famous hymn to human striving and delayed gratification. Life is real, life is earnest, he proclaims. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate. Still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. The waiting sounds good to me, Henry. Wake me up in an hour. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
You've been listening to Perchance to Dream, written by the members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Gay Davidson-Zilski, Luis Mancuso, Fran Rawl, Tracy Rosolowski, Karen Schultz, Sharon Van Sluice, Paul Thompson, Jackie Wilson, Jim Winship, and Fran Zell. Original music composed by Barbara Chusett. The vocals for the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. song were performed by 8-year-old Chamika House and her cousin Riviera Blackman, who's 9. The Sandman skit was written by Sue Renard, based on an idea by Pat Dijak. The Mind's Eye players included Sue Renard, Christian Newhouse, and Gordon Myers. The Naptime soundscape was produced by Kelly Warren. The Dreamlike music montage was arranged by Alex Wilding White. If you would like a tape copy of this show, or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525. If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended. That you have but slumbered here, while these visions did appear, in this weak and idle theme, no more yielding, but a dream. I'm Cole Hornhead.